My name is Judy, and I'm an alcoholic. At first, I was really nervous, but now I'm not, because Chuck gave me some real good advice. He said, you better be good. The room's packed. It's on tape now, Chuck. Well, I drank and used and abused for over 15 years, and then I went to Al-Anon so I could discuss everybody else's drinking. And I thought their problem was they didn't have enough willpower and self-control, and they obviously didn't know how to do it, so they didn't do it right. And I got those type of thoughts at a very young age. The majority of my family is alcoholics and addicts. And around my house, drinking was just as natural as eating, maybe more so. It was always allowed. Drugs were allowed. There was no problem. So I did what I wanted, and I did it to the extent that I wanted. And for the majority of the time, it was to escape what was going on around me, even though that's not what I said it was about. And I always thought that I could stop any time I wanted, until I wanted to and I couldn't. Then I decided that it wasn't that I couldn't, I just didn't really want to. So I kept it up. And just like everybody else, a lot of things happened to me because of it. You know, a couple of trips to Elmwood and several tickets and not hanging out at the best places in town or with the best people. And got the opportunity to see and do a lot of things that I wished I hadn't seen or hadn't done. But all of those put together became the experiences and the teachings of my life. So today I don't really regret them because they did teach me a lot. Hopefully today I don't have to be that thick-headed and that stubborn and learn such a hard way. But sooner or later it came time to take a look at things, and my road to recovery took me 8 years. I started out in a drug abuse clinic for a couple years, and I thought that my problem was just the drug that I was there for, so I quit that and switched to another. And that was my pattern for 8 years, you know, continuously drinking and constantly switching from one drug to another, thinking all the time that, you know, that particular thing was the problem, that if I just switched, I'd be okay. And after a while, the only thing I hadn't done was stick a needle in my arm, and now I know that if I ever go back out there, that's one of the yets that's still waiting for me. There are a few things that I haven't done. And again, I know that those things are out there waiting for me if I ever choose to drink or use again. And that's what this program tells me, and that's what I believe. I finally got to the point where anything other than total abstinence was not going to work for me. And I didn't want to believe that, and I didn't want to have to do it. For some reason, when I was young, I always thought that I was going to die at a very early age. And then I got sober and got scared I would live to be 90. But today that's okay. Because today is really beautiful for me, no matter how things are going or what's going on. You know, I've shared it before, and so have a lot of other people. My worst day sober, it has been always better than my best day high. And I get to experience that because I've come to these meetings and I've worked the steps and I've read the book and I've devoted myself to this program. Some of the experiences that have come down for me have just been incredible. If anyone had ever told me that in less than 2 years, the things that have happened to me would have already happened, I wouldn't have believed it. I would not have believed it. I go to school, and I get good grades. And when I was in high school, I thought an F meant because I finished the paper. I have an excellent job. My kids are happy. You know, they don't. There towards the end, my son wouldn't even talk to me. He was the one that had always said, Mommy, I love you, and he'd come running to me, and he'd always loved me no matter what. And all of a sudden, he was getting old enough to notice what was going on, and he just kind of avoided me and found another room in the house to be in. And that went on for about 2 months there at the end. I recently had a conversation with my ex-husband. And we have not talked in 2 years, and the last time we did, we threatened to kill each other, burn each other up, blow each other up, and just do each other in general, whichever way we could. and we were able to talk for a solid hour without a vulgar or threatening word passing our lips. And I didn't get along that way with people when I was drinking and using. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, you know. The most important kind of miracles that have come down in my life for me is the way I feel in here, inside where I really live. I don't feel like a garbage can anymore, and I don't feel worthless. I don't feel like a failure. I don't go measuring my life and my successes by other people's. You know, I just put one foot in front of the other and do the best I can. I'm really glad to see Mike here tonight, because one time he was chairing a meeting and he said something that did more for me and stuck with me more than anything else I've ever heard around here, because it gave me freedom and it gave me permission to forgive myself for my past and to accept the fact that today I'm no longer that person, and that I'm a good person and I'm a loving person and that I'm going to be okay. And that was when he shared that at one time he had morals and ethics and standards and rules just like everybody else had. And one by one, he'd given him up for more time out on the street. And, you know, they told me if I stuck around here long enough, I'd hear somebody tell my story. And that was it in a nutshell. That was exactly how it happened. You know, I don't know where and I don't know when, but somewhere along the line, I crossed that invisible line. And I thought I'd hit the point of no return. I thought there was no reason to turn back. I didn't think I was supposed to turn back. I didn't think I could. You know, I thought I was the way I was, and that's the way it was always going to be. And I came here, and they said, no, that's not true. We love you. We understand you. We've done some of the things you've done. We've experienced the things you've experienced. You're going to be okay. Just keep coming back, because it works. And I don't know why, except that there was a God working in my life even when I didn't give him permission to, and even when I didn't accept it. But he was working in my life, and for some reason, when I had been in situations where I should not have come out alive, I did. When maybe some innocent person shouldn't have come out alive, they did. And I made it to the doors of these rooms, and I haven't left yet, thank God, through the grace of God. I have not found it necessary to go back out there and have to come back in and try it again. I don't know if I have another attempt of sobriety in me, because I lived in the denial for a long, long time. And even when I was alone in my bedroom and the walls in the space was getting smaller and smaller and they were moving around when I wasn't touching them and the curtains were creeping on down the wall and the water was dripping when it wasn't on and all kinds of other things, you know, I didn't think I needed to be here. And lucky for me, I had already become associated with some of the people around here, and they knew I needed to be here. And they just stayed patient, and they just kept hanging in there with me. And then finally, I did what every real alcoholic and addict has to do. They have to make that call themselves. You know, if anybody else would have done it for me, I don't think I'd have been here today. And everybody here, like I said, they loved me, and they supported me, and they believed in me, but they gave me the dignity to walk my own program and to do what I had to do in here to keep sober and to keep clean and to keep coming back. And we've got 23 newcomers in here tonight, and I'm going to tell you the same thing. We love you, even though we don't know you. You're in the right place. Do yourself a favor and us, and keep coming back, because we need you. And we'll give you the dignity to do things that you'd never thought possible. Thank you.
Our main speaker has done an awful lot for my sobriety. He's always like the calm in the middle of a storm, so to speak. In any case, gives me great pleasure to introduce John C.
My name is John, and I am an alcoholic. It's a full moon tonight. Now, I'm not too sure why some of us are here. whether this is the place where the loonies come or this is where the sober people come to help the loonies. I really don't know. You know, I was thinking while all of this crazy stuff was going on that I think I'm kind of glad it wasn't here, even though I'm one of the instigators of Saturday Night Live. I think I'm kind of glad it wasn't here when I got here. Because you would have just scared the shit out of me. Calming influence. You know, it was on the 16th of March in 1976, with 4 days of sobriety, that I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not knowing, obviously, what I know today. When I walked into that room, it was out of great concern, thinking I was going to get a friend off of my back. And the fact that I was such a dreadfully honest person, that I had to satisfy some curiosities I had in my own mind, because he had given me this thing called 20 questions. And I had answered those. I had reviewed those 20 questions and answered them to myself with all of the honesty that I owned. And because of the shock that I got at the bottom of that thing, because he told me I could secretly ask these questions of myself, answer them to myself, and not divulge the results. And when I got to the bottom of them, knowing that I had missed 2.5, there was a suspicion in my mind that they had either rigged that goddamn thing or that there might be a problem in my life. And to this day, I wonder how I managed to justify a half a right and a half a wrong. But that was the degree of self-honesty that I attained when I got in here. And I want to tell you that from that night to this, my life changed. It changed and is changing, and by the grace of God, is going to continue to change. We hear a lot of talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about change being a scary thing. I have come to find out that that is not true. Now, I find what is going to happen this evening, I have the vaguest idea, and I hope so. I got to share this, and I hope seriously that I can get lost in this thing, because for reasons I don't know, tonight is a special thing. And I've spoken many, many times. At one time, when I got sober, I fell in love with a man called Chuck Chamberlain, Chuck C., who is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the great, great members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the tools that he gave me then are my tools today, plus those that you gave me. And I thought he was the greatest thing that ever came out. And when I finally had a chance to meet Chuck, I was about 4 months sober, and we had a meeting at St. Andrews where the day of sobriety is going on. And I thought, God, he's real. I've been listening to this tape solidly for 4 months. And when I say I've been listening to the tape, talk about being apeshit on something. I got crazy when I got in here. I got absolutely crazy. And I want to tell you something, first of all, before I even finish this, I got to tell you one thing. I am so grateful that there was nobody in this outfit that sounded and talked like me when I got here. Because I don't think I could have taken that shit. And to settle the minds of anybody in the room, no, I am not in any form of entertainment. I have never been a preacher in my goddamn life until I got here. I don't sell cars, new or old. I've been in the construction business all of my life. But when I met this man that night, I was overwhelmed because I had been listening to approximately 5 hours of him a day. I had his tapes going in my ear all the time. Why is it? The only thing I can that I can tell you today is the fact that he said things that were weird. I knew they made sense. And I thought they were true, but they made absolutely no sense in my gut at all. And I just kept listening to him and listening to them and listening to them, trying to figure out, what did he mean by what he said? I knew what he said. I wanted to know what he meant. And when I went to that meeting, and it was Chuck, and after the meeting, I'm still breathing heavy because I'm looking at some sort of a figure that epitomized to me a representative of the first God of my understanding. And he was real and he was tangible, and my lovely wife, bless her heart, who has no dignity whatsoever, said, "You want to meet him?" And I said, "Sure, I'd like to meet him." But I was very afraid, and she grabbed me by the hand and walked me up there, and she put her arm around that man, because she just is just a hussy and that sort of thing, and she didn't even know him. He turned around and kissed her and said, "Chuck, you don't know me. My name's Peggy. I've been sleeping with you for the last 4 months." I was not too productive when I got sober. And the man spoke real well because he said I was pretty good, wasn't I? I was afraid to touch him because he represented that much to me. And I was so taken by him, and I was so taken by sobriety that I wanted to be the next Chuck Chamberlain in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I put out those vibes, and I was asked to speak a lot of different places. And I enjoyed that. And then I come to realize that, you know, I don't have that thing that he has. And I lost interest in speaking, and as I lost interest in speaking, the requests to speak were disappeared. And I'm grateful for that because for more than one single factor. You see, I have found out in sobriety for me, I learned so much from the difficulties that other people have had in their sobriety. People have stand up here and shared with all the beauty that they have owned, and they said, "This is what I did, and I would tell you, don't do it." And I listened to them, and I believed them, and I tried not to do that. You see, in many respects, I'm an absolute pain in the ass when it comes to sobriety. And I don't ask that you believe anything that I have to offer this evening unless it's a quotation or something directly out of the book. But it is necessary for me to tell you the truth as I understand the truth and let the chips fall where they may, because it's not important anymore. Because I'm not out here to do anything other than share what it is that I've been given. And what I've been given is a new life. I've been given a new relationship with the world. And I came in without a drunk log and without any knowledge of it. And there's a lot of people that have asked me in the last couple of days, "Are you going to share it?" And I can only share it to you the way it was given to me. You see, I came in here and I could tell you a drunk story from time to time. If you asked a drunk story, I could tell you about the time in Chico when I was going crazy at the absolute depths of my life and didn't know it. It had anything to do with alcohol. And I can remember this, oh, the glorious feeling of waking up in a strange motel and looking at your body when you got up and you find out that you're all covered with blue stripes. And you say, "Oh, Jesus Christ, I got to go home tomorrow." And my wife lived several hundred miles away and I was commuting. And I'm saying, "God, this is weird." You know, and the only thing I can tell you is they washed off. You know, and I'm saying, "Where have I been? What have I done?" In the process of getting sober and listening to Chuck and getting swallowed up by the beautiful people that are dedicated to sobriety, they taught me many things. And what I've come to understand is that the fact that the book tells me that more will be revealed to me, that I was then and am now a very dedicated family man. I have dedicated my life to being a good father and to being a good husband. Because, Christ, I've always been a father and I've always been a husband, seemingly, because I married very young and I got a ton of kids. And the reason I say that it was concealed from me is because I don't believe I could have lived knowing what I knew when I found out. I hope that made sense. It sounded crazy. The reason I say that is because I had to come to get the power in order to look, in order to see, in order to accept what it was that came down on me. And so I got sober in the middle of March, and it was sometime in the middle of July that I went down in San the ego with a great deal of apprehension to go to the bowling tournament, the state tournament down there, with a group of people that every year they used to spend a year talking about the last drunk Carney had down at the bowling alley, because it was a big deal. I used to cut one hell of a big swat. It was good for at least a year's worth of talking. And I had to go down there and I had to break my anonymity to them for the first time. You see, my very last drink occurred in the bowling alley. On the night, last night is when I decided that I was going to stop. Until I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I did is I went down there and I was subjected to, in an intensity that defies description, the entire wreckage of my past in 2.5 hours. And it liked to drive me insane. I was given a spiritual tool at the time that I didn't know was a spiritual tool until after the fact. I was given a chain which has a great deal of symbolism to me, this chain that has no weak link in it. Thank God there's no clasp to this chain, because I believe seriously that if it had broken while I was holding on to it for dear life with both hands, because I wanted to kill people, I wanted to drink, I wanted to break it down, I was in absolute rage with the pain and the terror of the things that I was seeing. Because it was the greatest, I have found out today, it was the greatest single spiritual experience that I have undergone since I have been sober. And I wanted to point that out, because what I have found out in sobriety, that there is pain is the touchstone of growth, but by the same token, what are you going to do with it, is the cry that I've been given. The information you got isn't worth a shit unless you do something with it. And all of this stuff that was laid upon me in 2.5 years, or 2.5 hours, which was a lifetime, it represented 48 years of my lifetime condensed into 2.5 hours for me to recognize. I now knew why my first wife committed suicide. And I knew now what my participation was in that happy event. I knew then why it was that I had the opportunity to spend some time in a straitjacket in the crazy little soft room. And I knew then it was no accident, none whatsoever, that I stepped out of that saloon, quote, with a couple of drinks, which I've never had in my life, to look down the barrel of a .38, to go into the lineup for the armed robbery that I was charged with, that I couldn't tell you. I always said it was an accident. It was a case of mistaken identity. And I was the wrong place at the wrong time. It just so happens there happened to be about 4 hours of my life missing. And I didn't get that rap. And I can't look you in the eye and tell you I did or didn't do it, because I don't know. I wasn't there mentally. The blackouts that go through, you see, I can talk about this stuff. I now knew then why it was that my kids, and I'm absolutely wild about kids. I was talking with a beautiful young man here in front of the meeting, and I was saying, I'm one of those that go crazy over little kids, and I can sit and hold them and rock them and pat their little fannies all night long. You got a colic baby, give them to me, because that's what I did with all of mine, and I got 8. And I just pat them on the ass and just have a magnificent time and get up in the morning and feel great. Absolute best night rest I've ever had. And people looked at me like I was weird, and I was. And perhaps am today, but I don't give a shit today. Now, I knew why those little kids stopped wanting to sit on my lap. And I knew why it was that they left home so very early. And I knew why they didn't like to kiss their daddy anymore. And I knew why my little boy, who was then 8 when I got sober, used to run and hide when I came home. I could see that one. I could see that one. Oh, I didn't have any part of a drunkalogue when I got here. You see, because I had, because accidents bad breaks. They were doing something to me. I couldn't tell you the night down in the bad part of L.A. After a few drinks and turning around in an alley and being accosted by two guys who wanted my lady that I was with. And what I did behind that, there was two bodies in the room on the floor of that alley when I left. Okay. And all I could see was their blood. And my feeling, those son of a bitches better not touch me ever. And reading in the paper how one of them was probably not going to live. Didn't know that until I got sober. Just figured that's the way you did it. As I was born, and maybe this is part of my heritage, I come into this life of, as my mother calls, a blue baby. And I was pissed off and turning blue when I got born. I didn't cry very well, but I was waving my arms and waving my hands and grabbing. And I've been waving my arms and grabbing ever since. I didn't really learn how to talk until I got here, to the regret of a lot of people. The night I've born, there's a few people here, if you're fighting fans, because you're sure as hell not old enough. Well, there's a couple that are old enough. It was a night, September the 22nd, 1927, when Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney fought for the heavyweight championship of the world. My dad was a boxing fan, and I was going to be Jack Dempsey Carney, except that's the night Dempsey got screwed on the night of the long count. My dad was a very poor loser, so he named me Jack Gene, because they wouldn't want it. Gene Tunney didn't like him. He was a boxer, and Dad was a brawler, and he compromised. And you see, and then I got screwed right from the gate. The lady who filled out my birth certificate said Jack is a nickname for John, and Gene is a nickname for Eugene. And when I turned 18, I found out I no longer was a Jack, and I was no longer a Gene, and I've been a John Eugene ever since. Have you ever tried to change your name when you're in the United States Army? I don't mind fighting, and I've done a lot of it in my time, but I'll be goddamned if I was going to take on the U.S. Army over a name. I found out that I've been very, very good with my fists, and I don't know, that's part of my heritage. I've done a lot of amateur fighting. I've done some professional fighting, and I've done my share of it out in the streets. And one of the things that sometimes I don't really mention that is the fact that I don't have any scars. I don't have any broken bones, and you won't hardly find a cut on my body. And the reason for that is the fact that I found out in sobriety that I didn't know it then, I was so goddamn scared that I was so goddamn fast that I became awfully goddamn good. And that's how I got involved in the area that I got involved in with a rough group. And knowing that I had the ability to defend myself in a very aggressive fashion, I was absolutely convinced, and I had the ability then, I hope not now, to convince anyone that they had better not screw with me. And I think that's so funny today, because I'm just a little shit compared to some of the mooses around here. But I had the absolute total conviction I had never met and never would meet the man I couldn't be. I could just see me approaching somebody like Don Cup. Say, you little shit, sit down or I'll knock your ass. And I was one of those. I could do that. But very few people wanted to fight with me. What happened to me is I was leading a bad life, if you want to call it that, capitalizing upon my ability to attack and defend. I married my childhood sweetheart, and we were given a little baby, and my life changed. Changed dramatically. Because I had this little thing in my arms, and I wanted it so badly, and I loved it so much, and I wanted so desperately to give it all the good things that I've ever thought I wanted. And so I changed my field. I got involved in the trade that I'm currently in and dedicated my life to becoming a businessman. I stopped my old friends. What we're talking about is what my book talks about. A huge emotional displacement where my thoughts and attitudes and outlook on life changed. And I had it then. And it was very dramatic, and I became a different person. I started, as my sponsors say, walk to the beat of a different drummer. Because I didn't want to live that old life anymore. You see, and I was going to become successful. And I did that one. Alcohol was very definitely part of it, but I can't give you stories about alcohol. I can tell you about what I did and what I felt. You see, I was on the outside of this world looking at it. Is the only way I can tell you. And it wasn't because I didn't think I could belong. It's because I didn't want to belong. You see, it was a dirty goddamn place, this world. And I was just trying to protect my kids and my wife. The world was rotten. It was gray. Everybody was out to get something and take something from me and mine, and you weren't going to do it. And so I shut the world off because I didn't want to belong to you. Because they didn't like you. Because you were bad. And I was going to be good. And what happened is that through my alcoholism and an involvement with my first affair of, first and only, I would add, affair of my life, my wife saw fit to depart this world by her own hand. And I heard that on the telephone from a friend. And I had another huge emotional displacement. When I woke up in my straitjacket, remembering just pieces of how it was that I got in it and the damage that was caused, going absolutely crazy because I had five little girls out there that needed me, and I had to get them, and I didn't know where they were. I didn't even know they were alive. And I had to get out of that goddamn nut house. I had to get out so fast to take care of them. And you turn an alcoholic in a sense of desperation into a place like that, there you got to get out. You will adjust. And I adjusted damn fast. I got out on parole to attend the funeral. And 2 days later, I was given a total discharge without need of further psychiatric care. Because I did everything I was supposed to do. Another crazy, and I, because there were shortage of guards, and oh God, it's full moon. It was a full moon in July. You ever been in a nut house on a full moon in July in Los Angeles when it's 120 and the heat and the full moon and the crazies are out? And there's only one guard on the floor who's hiding behind a cage because he doesn't dare get out. So a couple crazies, old Joe, Deborah Sini, bless his heart. He and I, because you see, if you were good, you got matches and you could light your own cigarettes. I'm sure somebody's been there. You know that. They won't let you have matches. But if you're good and you are taking care of the crazies for the guard that's too afraid to get outside, they let you have your own matches. Hey, that was fun, man. People come to you and say, got a light? No. The total experience of playing God. And I ate it up. Came out of the nut house. I gathered my little girls and I said, there's something wrong with this shitty world. And I know what my problem is. It's Southern California. So I came up here. And I became the best mother and the best father that I knew how to be. And that was a good one. I learned how to cook. Because I wanted one of those macho dudes who said, I can't even boil water without burning it. But I learned how to cook. I learned how to iron. In those days when Some of you ladies, I'm sure, when all the frillies were on, they didn't have wash and wears, lace, dresses, five little girls, puff sleeves. Huh? Puff sleeve? I told this the other night. Sometimes this comes up, sometimes it don't, but one dress was outstanding. I was teaching myself how to iron sitting down. Because I wasn't going to listen to this old bitch about standing up and ironing, because that's what the ladies always say, oh God, I got to stand up and iron. It's killing my feet. I worked all day, and I'd come home all night and do all the cooking and washing and ironing and take care of my little kids, and I had nothing but white shirts. That was long before wash and wear, and I didn't have any money, and I learned how to iron. I scorched the lace on this beautiful brown dress, and it was just covered with lace. It had lace collar, yoke, puff sleeves, lace, and rows of lace. And rows! It was a beautiful, full, dark brown skirt, and I scorched the lace, and I spent 2.5 hours scorching the rest to match. If you're going to be the best goddamn mother and the best goddamn father, you better do it right. See, you don't even understand, goddammit. You're laughing at the wrong things now, too. You did that the first time I came into a meeting. Probably one of the attractions that came. I met a lady. About a year later, I met a lady that represented a lot of things that I really liked. She was the best damn father and the best damn mother that she knew how to be, and she didn't want to get married either. And 8 weeks later, we both got married to each other. I proposed to her between the butter and the mayonnaise. No, it was the mayonnaise and the peanut butter in the grocery store while we're shopping for the kids. Very romantic. It required, I'll tell you, another huge emotional displacement where your thoughts, attitude, and outlook on life had changed. Now I'm already in my third one. And I was a big wheel when we got married. By then I had worked up and I was once again a big wheel, making a lot of money. And I wanted you to know that for the next 15 and a half years, every year I made less money. And I didn't know that until I got sober. I was in the cesspool of the state of California in Fresno then, having all of those beautiful Armenians taking all of my money, invested handsomely in the economy. And one more time, I'm down to the bottom of the barrel. And I said, oh, God. This time I knew it. I knew it. I was a total failure in every department of life, and I had a chance to look at it. And I can say that because I know it. And I started to explain to my wife all of the bad things that had gone wrong were not bad things. They were my fault. I should have done it better. It's on me. And bless her heart, the Al-Anon that she was, she said, one more time. Try it one more time. You can do it one more time. And that's what I was doing when I got here. One more time. My last year before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was once again there. I had more money than I've ever had in my life. At that time, I was making more money than I'd ever made. I had money in the bank. I owned my house. I had 2 cars. I had a job that made me more damn money than most people in any room of Alcoholics Anonymous will make. And I knew they were going to get me, and I was going to hide it. One more time, I wasn't going to go down the tubes. And that's when this lovely man, who didn't know the rules of Alcoholics Anonymous, who had 7 days of sobriety, brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And 9 months later, I'm stone ass broke one more time. But you see, that huge emotional displacement occurred. Another huge emotional displacement occurred when I was in Fresno. I got another one when I got here. But for the first time in my entire life, I was given something to go with it, a direction to follow behind all of this information. And I got the information in my 4-step. The information I needed, but I got all of the information when I was in San Diego. And so that's why I don't have a drunkologue that I can tell you in the fashion by which it happened. I hear other people tell stories and I can say, oh, I did that one too. I heard Paz talk about the horrifying fights that his father and his mother used to have. My daddy did that too, but I don't remember it that way. The only thing I remember about my daddy is the fact the last time he fought was with me. And he didn't dare fight any after that. Because I was 15 or 16 and he carried his scars to his grave. And I got to look at him with disgust because I was too goddamn good. I shouldn't have fought him. That was my story. I shouldn't have fought him and hurt him. It was my daddy. And I get to see those scars and watch and say, oh, you did it again, you son of a bitch. One more time, you walk in a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this was my conviction, the good ones die. Son of a bitches like me get to live. You can't live in this goddamn world without helping, hurting other people. When am I going to get mine? The world is out to take from me. That was my philosophy on life, and I didn't want any part of the world. And I got here, and a huge emotional displacement occurred. I was given some directions, and I was given the glorious words of this man I call Chuck Chamberlain, Chuck C. And I started studying them, and I like to tell you, you see, one of the reasons I tell you that I don't believe that I have a message is because I got to stand up in front of rooms like this, and I can't tell you, don't do it my way. You see, I got to impress everybody with my pride and ego and say, oh God, please do it my way. And the reason I say that is my life changed from the gate. Within 2 weeks, I was absolutely crazy about Alcoholics Anonymous. Within 2 weeks, I was starting to talk and live my way into sobriety. Until I got the information, I charged through those steps. I needed the information I got in the July. 4 months sober, I got the information I needed that was withheld from me in order to launch me through these steps. And in the middle of August, less than 30 days later, a loving God had delivered to me every single member who was on my list of amends. In addition to that, the fabulous things that happened, He had delivered unto me the list of everybody that was on my wife's list of amends for me to make too. God, and it was fabulous. I could give you just one fast story on that one. This person I didn't harm, this person I did a great deal of good for. There were a few of them out there that I did that to. But because of the alienation that existed between my daughter and her in-laws, and it's her in-laws that caused the problem. She's a bad drunk and she's not yet in this fellowship. And I had made peace between them, and because of her resentment towards me and the fact that she knew I hated her guts, my daughter could not share the family life, and they had to live over there and pretend we didn't exist and come over here and pretend they didn't exist is the way it went. And it was horrifying for her. And Peggy told me, she said, John, how about Jack and Bonnie and B? And I said, okay, that's a good one. But I haven't even seen them in 6 years. I don't remember what they look like. She said, well, if you're really willing. And I said, Christ, I'm willing to anything. She said, well, we were in the bowling alley at the time. She said, they just walked in. And that's the way it was for me. And that's the way it was for me. You see, if I had not done exactly and precisely what was directed of me, I would have not have had the willingness to do that. And I want to know, I couldn't have tackled something like that. And I had no reservations through these steps. I started with them. I had no reservations. You allowed me the freedom to choose a loving God of my own understanding. Okay. And my chapter to the agnostic told me that God was everything or He is nothing. He either is or He isn't. And you allowed me the choice to make. And I knew full well that there had to be one. And oh, I did know when I got here that I was tired of playing God. There was no God in my life but me. And I was so tired of it. Because the huge awarenesses that were given to me, I had destroyed everything of any value to me in my entire life. And I had done it repeatedly. Repeatedly. for reasons. Today I can tell you that I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of. Okay? The spiritual awakening that I have reference to is perhaps contrary to the beliefs of everybody in the room. Because I got some fundamental beliefs. And you don't have to believe them, I do. I have to believe them because they're true for me. We hear in the fellowship, we hear around here, that all we've ever looked for all of our life and ever needed is to be loved and accepted. Loved and accepted. And I don't believe that's true at all. I don't believe that's true for a minute. See, the God of my understanding has given me some information. And it's a truth for me. And you don't have to take it. You don't have to take it, but I have to. You see, my whole business in this business of living is not to be loved and to be accepted. My whole business is to love and to do. To love and to do. That's what I was really looking for. I had it backwards. I've had it backwards all my life. I want to be loved. Love me. Love me. Accept me. I was unlovable and unacceptable. But I said, take me the way I am and love me, please. And no, that's not how it was. I had to love you and I had to accept you. I had to do for you. In the process of loving and doing, things happen in my life. Okay, and I don't have to sell that one. It's the truth for me. That's the way it is. You see, I understand some basic facts about this spiritual awareness that I have been given. And they are contained in having had a spiritual awakening as the result of steps that I have taken. I have found out that I have never been without since before I was born. Chuck C. says it, God's gift to us was made at the foundation of the universe. Long before I was Jack or John, I've had it. I was born with it. I've always had it. Everything I've ever needed. And we talk about needs in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you may need anything. You may feel that you need something, and if you do, you do, because you need it. But I have no needs today. And I have no needs today, and I will tell you why. Because my needs have been mine all along. I have always had it. The God of my understanding is a God of abundance. He will give to me that which I will receive. That which I will receive. Not that which I will demand or insist upon or grab. That which I will receive. And the way I receive it is to make myself ready to receive it. Not by demanding it, but by accepting what is given to me. God, I'm getting into a preacher. Getting pretty serious here. That's all right. Haven't scared anybody out yet. You see, what I've got confused all of my life is what I want. You see, I want a lot of things. And it is the wants. And I had to learn to separate wants from needs. You see, I have wants. If I want it bad enough, I need it. And if I need it, baby, get out of my way. Because the guy that came to his first meeting can easily come out again and say, it's mine. I need it. Because a need can be classified, in my opinion, because it is classified, in my opinion, as an obsession. I had an obsession over alcohol. And there wasn't enough in this world of alcohol to satisfy my obsession. If I had a case I wanted to, God help you if you approached me for a drink when I was down to the last half. You couldn't. I was concerned about it. There wasn't enough, and there isn't enough alcohol in the world to satisfy the obsession I have for alcohol once I start drinking it. If the Pacific Ocean was full of Jack Daniels, some of you bastards would be taking my booze. And I would be staking claim on the Atlantic. That's what an obsession is, and that's what I classify a need. And when I have come to the grips with the fact that I have been born with, have always had everything I've ever needed, some of the great obsessions fall off of my shoulders. And I recognize now I get the freedom that they're talking about. I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of the loving God of my understanding is all loving. And I think I would suggest that probably anyone in this room would not conflict with this. All loving, ever present, all powerful, all forgiving. And I came to grips with that all forgiving thing at the very beginning of this thing. You see, there is but one God. And I had made the decision early that it could not be me because my book told me. It could not be me. It was but Him. Everything or nothing, what's your choice? You make it one time, and I made it one time because I was taught one time. You make it one time, and the rest of it, you can screw with your gourd till hell freezes over. You don't alter the decision. He's everything, and it's not me. So He's all-powerful and all-forgiving, and if I cannot forgive me, I'm denying the existence of a loving God. Now, I cannot do that. I lived for 48 years denying the existence of what it was that I felt deep down in my gut, as my book tells me. The fundamental concept of God was down here and was down here all along. And I was just like a fish, hooked, fighting desperately to get off the hook, thinking I was running from getting mine. And when I gave up the fight, I got here. When I stopped trying to get, everything was given. When I stopped trying to tell you, love me. And I learned how to love you. You see, I'm backwards. And I'll tell you, I'm backwards to most of the stuff you're going to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's the way I learned it, and I can't deny it. I've never spent one goddamn second figuring out whether I love me or didn't. Because I don't really know how to do that one. You see, I gave that one up when I accepted the fact that there was a God. And whether I like me or don't like me, I haven't got a goddamn thing to do with nothing. You see, my job is to love and to do. Now, if you want to look at me, and this is what I can tell you about me, I like what I do, but I'll be damned if I have to look in the mirror to do anything other than shave, because I did that one when I was pretty, and then I stopped doing that when I got ugly. And it's not necessary for me to figure out which one I am, because I've been both. I know what I am inside, and my job is about the business of allowing my insides to come outside to share with you so that you will see and you will be given what I was given when I got here, some identification. I was said, what about this power that you guys are talking about? Where do you go to find it? And he said, look at us. Something's working. Identify what's happening in our life. Something's going on inside. Look at it. And try and identify it. And then go inside and try and find it. And I did that one and it worked for me. You see? And I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I've been given a set of principles. And my principles aren't yours necessarily. Practice them in all of your affairs. Okay, now there are some very lofty phrases that one can offer relative to principles. Admission, submission, surrender, self-examination, confession, most of which I find very objectionable to me. Because I don't like, although I use them all the time, I really don't think the way I talk. I'm much simpler in my thoughts than my mouth. Can't help it, this is the way it comes out. But if you want to talk about principles, and this is the way I live it, to the best of my ability, now you have to understand. But what I'm saying is what I'm striving for, and I have perfect ideals, and I am willing to grow towards those perfect ideals, and I do not have to stand before anyone and say, I'm not perfect, because for Christ's sake, I am a human being. That in itself tells you the degree of my perfection. I understand the definition of a human being. But I have goals, and they are perfect goals, and my book says that that is what I strive for. And I get to claim progress, because that's what my book tells me I claim. I don't measure progress, because I was told early on, if you start measuring, you got a fool reading the tapes. You can't measure your own progress, you dumb shit. Claim it and do certain things, and certain things are going to happen. Because I don't want to turn the fool loose trying to figure out whether I'm better than you or not. Because I knew when I got here I was better than you, and I found out I was wrong. I have a great examination. I have a great yardstick that I use to develop how much I know in sobriety and how well I can handle my own life. And I phrase it very simply, the greatest single moment of my entire life was when I went to the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a pits. I was there and I missed it. The greatest, most euphoric thing that could have happened in my entire life, and I was there and missed it. So what the hell do I know about what's best for me? So I got a fool that's making judges like that, and I need all the help I can get. And they come through the process of the principles, and they're very simple for me, and I have rephrased them. Step one, I got a problem, and I'm it. Step one, that's it. Now, my book tells me, justify it, when I'm emotionally disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. I got a problem, and it's me. That's my principle. Step one, I do it all the time. Step two, you gonna do anything with it, Johnny? You just gonna sit here with it, or you gonna do something with it? My preference is to do something with it. Do you want a solution? Step two. You're willing to go? Go for it. Step three. Where are you going to go, John? Did you mean it when you said it? When you turned your will and your life over to the care of loving God? Because that's where the power comes. That's where it comes from. That's where all comes from. You can't do it yourself. Are you going to go to the right source? Then you get inventory. What's wrong with you, John? That's what I say. That's my principle. What's wrong with you? I look at mine. I don't want to spend any more time with you. Good God, I spent all my life looking at you, and it got me here. Shit. I want to do better now. What's wrong with you? That's four. Oh, God, I got to tell somebody. I got to admit my own foolishness. You see, you get proud when you get sober. And you get all spiritual when you get sober. And you know how to show your warts. Twice. Three times. The same stuff. I don't want anybody to know me. But you see, the decision is the principle. You going to tell him? Six and seven, magnificent step. Steps, magnificent. Absolutely magnificent. Because the way I say it, my six and seven step is so simple for me because it goes like this. You tell me, Father, and I stop. You see, I can't do anything with me. But what has happened to me is that in a spiritual awakening, there are new thoughts coming in my mind. There are new attitudes. There is a whole displacement of my whole attitude on this world. And the deal is, you tell me, Father, and he does, I'll stop. Six and seven, that's my principle. God, that's neat. Eight. Why don't you get along with them, John? That's perhaps a little simpler than for me than re-self-examination. Why don't you get along with them, John? 9. Tell them about it. Do something about it. That's 9. The simplest formula you'd ever want to know. Because you get 10 to remind you, have you been doing it right, John? And you get to go through this daily. Have you been doing it right? Oh, I'm not talking about this business of living. You do the principles right, and your life works. And it works good. 11, are you doing it some more? Do you love him? Do you love him? And I do. Have you talked to me lately? And I do. Do you sit quiet with him lately? And I do. So I said under 12, and I know. You see, I know. That's my principle of having had a spiritual awakening. I know. Practicing the principles is once again a reaffirmation of 10. Are you doing it, John? The last half of the 11th, or of step 12, are you doing it? To love and to do is what my belief is. To love and to do. Are you doing it? And I'm not asking for perfection. I'm asking to do the very best I can. And that's what I've tried to do tonight. Thank you.